This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Pastoral Medicine. This is lecture 6. Dear friends, so far we have been chiefly concerned with discovering how far a human being may deviate during his life in one or the other direction from what can be called normal, toward a pathological condition or toward a connection to the real spiritual world. Today I would like to go beyond the single earth life to show, with the help of a rather obvious example, how the karma that a human being carries through repeated earth lives must sometimes relate itself to entirely contrasting conditions, such as, for instance, a capacity to reach into the spiritual world, and in the same human being, a need to reach down into the bodily, natural realm. For truly, if a physician wants to practice his profession, not only with good external measures and with intelligence, but with his whole heart, with all his human capacities, he needs to stand, may I say, within the spiritual world and look at this physical world from a spiritual point of view. The human being journeys through successive earth lives. Causes reach over spiritually from one earth life and evoke consequences in a subsequent life. Therefore, karma cannot remain a mere word to us. We must learn how to relate our healing activity to karma. For this, we must first be fully aware of how karma works in relation to pathological conditions and also in relation to visionary capacities. If the priest wants to enter into his parishioner's life situations in the right way, if he wants to be a real pastor to the souls in his care, he also needs to appreciate the spiritual significance of what confronts a human being in his everyday life on this earth. Only then will he be able to care for humanity properly from the standpoint of the spirit. In this connection, there is something we should consider for a moment that, from a modern, more enlightened point of view, can indeed be regarded by some with a certain derision. If we, too, presumed to take such an attitude, our descendants would surely magnify it 100-fold in their estimation of us. For they will view us in future centuries as anyone living today in our so-called scientific culture views our ancestors. You will see at once what I mean. In the course of human evolution, a complete reversal has taken place in the conception of illness. This became particularly obvious at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. If you go back 2,000 years or so, to the early times of the Old Testament, you find a universal conviction that illness comes from sinfulness, that illness has its original spiritual cause in sin. This was a serious belief. There had to be a spiritual error or failure somewhere as the true cause when a physical illness appeared. And this idea was carried further. It was believed of a person in whom the spiritual fault lay causing the illness that he harbored some elemental spiritual force that did not belong in him, that somehow he was possessed. In those olden times, all illness signified that a human being was possessed by some spiritual entity as the consequence of his spiritual error or fault. And the therapy was created accordingly. It was based on finding the means to bring out of the ill person the alien, elemental spirituality that had entered into him through his spiritual offense. Basically, this was the belief that one does not understand an illness unless one knows its ill cause. And now, consider the belief that came later, pronouncing exactly the opposite view. Before psychoanalysis intervened in such frightfully dilettante fashion. The new belief said, every sin can be traced to illness. People were convinced of it, If there was a criminal, a quote-unquote sinner, somewhere, the concept sin was defined rather superficially according to the legal code. They saw to it that in some way or other they got hold of his brain after death, and could thus examine his physical organism. They were looking for the defects. And they did find defects in many instances. In this respect, they have advanced quite a little. Clever, well-trained scientists have adopted the view that if a man is a perfect physical organism, he doesn't sin. He sins if there is some bodily defect. Sin comes from disease. That's how evolution goes, not in a straight line, but by way of opposites. And the people who have now reached this last view, not everyone today admits to it, but it is often fundamental, even for those who do not totally subscribe to it. These people look back with pity to olden times when it was believed that illness comes from sin. For they know they themselves are right, that sin comes from illness. And they know with absolute certainty that in the sick person there is some material process or other that they have to combat, have to neutralize, have to get out of the organism. In earlier times, the healers worked to remove a host of elemental spirits. To someone who sees the matter from a broader point of view, there is really not very much difference. From an inner standpoint, there is no great difference between the health spas that materialistic medicine considers correct and lords. In the latter, a person is cured through religious beliefs, in the former through materialistic beliefs. These things must simply be looked at without prejudice. If one is influenced by such, may I say, short-sighted ideas, one certainly will not perceive the real connections. Today, therefore, I would like to describe a concrete case. And really, one should always offer concrete examples when one is dealing with such matters. This case should reveal to you the deeper connections to be found in this matter of human health. So, a certain person lived in the 19th century. I'll speak of him presently as he was in the 19th century, but first I want to take you back to one of his earlier incarnations, not the immediately preceding one, but an earlier one that had important consequences for his life in the 19th century. This person was incarnated in a southeastern region of Asia, where the people were extraordinarily fond of animals. You know that Oriental teachings include a great reverence for animals, as well as love for them. They extend what they call love of man and love of things, particularly to love of animals. In ancient times, it was quite natural for the people in this region to love animals intensely and to take very good care of them. And now the man of whom I am speaking was no friend of animals. There, due to still earlier incarnations, which we will not examine now, in the very midst of an animal-loving people, was a man who treated them cruelly. Already as a boy, he tormented them. He was mean to them. In later life, he tortured the domestic animals in every possible way, to an incredible degree. This aroused violent anger in the folk among whom he lived. Also, he experienced a deep conflict between this compulsive mania, today we would call it in materialistic terms, perversion of the will, and on the other hand, the spiritual teachings of the people. He took these up with great fervor. He was able to relate himself to them completely. He had a fine sense for everything the religion of that area taught. But he became involved in violent conflicts with precisely the most religious individuals around him because of his animal torture. It was especially the animals in his own house that he tortured, first among his relatives, later when he became a kind of farmhand. It is the domestic animals upon which the Orientals lavish good care, considering them part of their very family. And these were the ones he tortured most shockingly. Now, as I said, we will not concern ourselves with an incarnation lying in between, for it is not of much importance for this man's subsequent incarnation. But he lived again in our age, in the first half of the 19th century, and in this incarnation, which in a wider sense belongs to our own time, he was born as an extremely fearful person, so that he chained dogs to himself. One could say this was now a symptom of illness, this abnormal relation, again, to animals. It did have an aspect of disease about it, through the fact that he did not develop any special love for the dogs, only a feeling that he had to have them near him. It is clearly fantastic, the way he related himself to them. It reveals an inner karmic compulsion from an earlier life. At the same time, the man is, in this incarnation, an extremely talented individual, carrying over from his earlier life everything he had experienced of the Oriental spiritual teachings, also his own religious devotion. This is not just a feeling in him, it becomes his life practice. In the course of this, he not only develops an astonishing fantasy about spiritual things, but he develops the ability to put into poetic form correct visionary imaginations that come to him in an elementary, matter-of-course way. His poetry is about ordinary physical human life, into which elemental spiritual beings constantly play. He is a distinguished poet. Moreover, one may truly say he is the dramatist whom we Europeans would compare most seriously with Shakespeare. He is Ferdinand Raimund. Raimund, with his fantastic personality, his giant talent, whose dramatic poems show how he was brought from earlier incarnations, his ability to portray spiritual things, to put spiritual happenings into human life. One need only look at titled Der Alpenkönig und der Menschenfeind, The King of the Alps and the Misanthrope, to be able to liken him to Shakespeare. First of all, he is an important actor. This comes from his impulse to bring trivialities and non-trivialities from spiritual realms to the stage. On the stage, he is an incomparable actor, full of humor. In life, he is completely overwhelmed by the consequences of the animal torture that he formerly perpetrated. Genius and a pathological condition are thoroughly mixed in him. The genius impelling him to create with soul spiritual dramatic instinct and Shakespearean power, the pathological condition impelling him to inject a fantastic element into his external daily life. Now we must look at the singular trait in Ferdinand Raimund. You see, the animal torture had been a quote-unquote necessity to him in that earlier incarnation. He had experienced a kind of lust. He did it for secret pleasure. He was not aware during that earth life that it was bad. He came to that realization after he went through the gate of death. Now the experience one has when one goes through the gate of death, and then further into the life between death and a new birth, is in the subsequent life expressed foremost, in a wide sense, in the head organization. There lies the impulse one brings with one as talent. This Raimund brought with him in rich amount. But here, also, something is working that appears in the rhythmic system, particularly the upper rhythmic or respiratory system, for man is built like this. If we put it into a diagram, and there's a drawing, metabolic limb system, rhythmic system, nerve sense system. What comes from an earlier earth life works over into the nerve sense system of the new life. What comes from the time between death and a new birth works over into the rhythmic system. And what comes from the new earth life works alone in the metabolic limb system. So, all that this individual, who is now Ferdinand Raimund, experienced of bitter remorse, of deeply crushing insight, was working continually after that earlier incarnation in his life between death and a new birth, affecting his coming rhythmic system. It worked right into the physical body. For in the physical organization of the head, we have the after effect of the previous earth life. In the physical organization of the rhythmic system, we have the after effect of the life between death and a new birth. These facts are obvious when one studies embryology, even externally. In the case of Ferdinand Raimund, in his breathing system, the upper rhythmic system, we see working in him all the bitter remorse and insight which he had experienced when he went through the gate of death from that previous earth life. This experience led inevitably to breathing irregularities in this life, to a meager intake of oxygen and a strong saturation of carbon dioxide. Breathing irregularities, from a physical point of view, bring on a variety of states of anxiety. They can be the carriers of elemental beings of anxiety. The breathing irregularities do not allow the proper balance of oxygen and carbon dioxide in the breathing process, and this draws in anxiety elementals. You can see all this entitled The King of the Alps and the Misanthrope. It was well developed in Raimund. He was predisposed, if we use the technical expression, to a breathing system that would be a carrier for anxiety elementals. Such elemental beings as these are not simply anxiety elementals. If, at the same time, there is something such as Raimund had in his head system from earlier earth lives, namely soul spiritual ideas, which make his dramas so interesting, then one sees that the presence of these anxiety demons causes karma to develop in a very definite direction. One sees clearly how they push in an unhealthy way to bring about karmic effects. They stream, may I say, into fanciful imaginations that even achieve visionary content, and Raimund's dramas are built on such content. They stream into his visionary activity. They also impel him to develop a fantastic element in his daily life. In this way, a karmic stream pushes through his life, a tremendous gift of genius that has to come to expression. One branch of the stream flows in a special kind of spiritual creation. The other branch flows parallel in a kind of life fantasy that is not expressed externally, but is directed inward, for it lies in the rhythmic system, which is, of course, half inward, but which also works in his lower organs in such a way that it affects a person's external life, and then in turn influences his inner life again. So Raimund's genius is accompanied by a truly pathological tendency, and this pathological tendency, which expresses itself through the anxiety demons, is the vehicle for the fulfillment of his karma. One can see Raimund's karma quite clearly. He has to keep a dog. He is a fantastic person. He does what other men wouldn't do. One can understand that. One can even sympathize with that. Indeed, when I remember how some of our worthy citizens have gorged themselves at court banquets when they were being given distinguished titles, I have a certain sympathy for Raimund with his wry humor as he sits on the floor and eats with a dog out of the dog's bowl. You see how karma plays in from the animal torture of his earlier incarnation. You see how this deed comes from the animal torture and the remorse after death, and is done as a fantastic atonement. But the atonement has to be still more severe. Immediately after this, the anxiety demons appear and take part in the playing out of his karma. Raimund becomes obsessed by the thought, the dog has rabies, I have been eating with him, now I am infected. Raimund is terrified. While at other moments he can do the most talented things on the stage, the moment he withdraws from his external life, he succumbs to the compulsive fear that he is infected with rabies. Now he undertakes a journey with a friend. They go from Vienna to Salzburg, and there the fear of madness so overwhelms him that he must return at once to Vienna to get treatment. It is a tormenting journey, both for him and for the friend. One sees his pathological state always following at the heels of his genius. And now he is well taken care of. People are delighted to entertain Ferdinand Raimund. Gradually he abandons the rabies idea. Something like a cure takes place through life itself, through pleasure, through the kindness he receives on every side, which he doesn't really want to accept because he is still a hypochondriac. And the anxiety demons torment him, if not with one trouble, then with another. So he is always swinging back and forth between Raimund the humorist and Raimund the hypochondriac. But at least he has given up the idea that he might become mad. That fear had obsessed him for years. Even so, he is still bound to animals. After 10 years, he gets another dog. And now, see what happens. He plays with the dog, and the dog does really bite him. Again, the thought of it overpowers him. He is standing there. He is bitten by the dog, and the dog has rabies. Actually, it was established later that the dog did have rabies, but it was a very light case. Now Raimund travels to Pottenstein, shoots himself in the head. The bullet lodges in the posterior cavity, far back. It can't be operated on. Raimund dies from the shot after 3 days. You see how Raimund has freed himself from the first obsession, but karma continued to work. This is an example of karma working itself out completely in a remarkable way. For only think, subjectively, it is not precisely a suicide, for Raimund could not be called a fully responsible individual. Objectively, it is also not precisely a suicide, for if they had been able, in those days, to operate on that part of the head, Raimund would have been saved. At that time, the operation was not possible, and they had to leave the bullet in the head, so that after 3 days, death was inevitable. So it was not a pure suicide, either subjectively or objectively. Thus, one cannot say there will be consequences in the karma because of suicide. The karma does not continue. It was balanced out by what Raimund experienced in this incarnation up to his death, up to the way his suicidal intention was carried out. One sees clearly how karma, from his earlier incarnation, rises up and strikes him in this incarnation. One sees it reach across the span of time to strike with strength. So now, first, we have seen that there are individuals whose ego, astral body, and etheric body develop either suddenly or by stages, in such a way that they break into the spiritual world with a visionary capacity, St. Teresa, Mechthild of Magdeburg, and many others. There are such individuals who show an abnormality in one direction, the direction of spiritual awareness. They have been given some karmic gift, which we are only considering from the aspect of this particular earth life. With these individuals, we do not need to enter into karmic details. Naturally, it is a fulfillment of karma. But one can understand the case from a single earth life. And then there are the individuals turned in the other direction, whom we considered yesterday. These individuals develop abnormally in their physical etheric organism. They sink down into their physical body and become pathological cases, as I showed you, in 3 stages. Their pathological condition is induced by their karma. But one only needs to look at the general picture. With such personalities as St. Teresa, the individual became especially strong in earlier earth lives, while in the pathological cases, the individual became especially weak, causing his higher being to be drawn down into his lower organism. Again, one needs only to look at a few general characteristics of the individual, one need not examine his karma in detail. But now in Ferdinand Raimund we have an unusual personality. He developed not only in the visionary direction, but in the opposite direction also, and at the same time. We have the two opposites constantly pitted against each other throughout his life. Both are in his personality, the genius and the psychopath. They play into each other, on the one side wonderfully, on the other side tragically. We are obliged in this case, therefore, to study the concrete details of his karma. We have to perceive how his karma works to create the two extremes, how it holds them apart, sometimes letting them work into each other. You will find countless places in Raimund's dramas where you can say his spiritual vision is active, and at the same time something is working in from the anxiety demons. Sometimes you see it in the structure of the drama itself. You see, if we study human character in this way, we come inevitably to a consideration of karma. And we must see, on the one hand, the one-sidedness of that abstract teaching from certain ancient streams of civilization, namely, that illness comes from sin, which means that only abnormal spirituality is active in the human being. Naturally, certain ideas can be expressed in this abstract way, but they remain theories, even if one treats people in accordance with them. The opposite assertion is just as abstract and just as one-sided, that sin comes from illness, and that there are physical substances and processes in some human being to be combated. We have to investigate, first of all, the concrete details of the total human organism, how its upper members relate to each other, whether they are separated from each other, whether they distance themselves from the lower members. Likewise, we must be able to see how karma is working in such an interplay of genius and pathology, as was the case with Raimund. Whoever achieves an understanding of these things will find opportunities in life to add something more to what he is already accomplishing in his work of physical healing, to add words that will make the healing process complete. He will reach the moment when he is no longer bound merely to a physical healing process, seeking the why and the wherefore of physical healing alone, for he will perceive how necessary it is in many cases to add a moral dimension to it. This does not mean that one shall become sentimental and go calling on one's patients with all kinds of trifling consolations. Usually such things have little effect. Sick people haven't much energy left for weepy tea-time callers or for hearty pipe-pal jollities either. They do have an amazing amount of energy left for what lies in natural human relations, not the what of words, but the how. One finds one's way instinctively in such situations, if one is able to express one's view of the world and of life in a way that relates them to spiritual connections, as it can relate to them if one takes seriously such examples as I have described. Dear friends, spiritual activity cannot consist of talk, much less of religious tirades. Spiritual work must relate to facts. If it takes hold of facts, then it will be useful, first of all, to make the necessary connections with human beings. Then it can be used for healthy people and sick people. One will develop an instinct for orienting oneself to any illness with this or that symptom. You will see that this extends to physical illnesses as well. But we must first open up the way to see that these things apply to physical illnesses. You will come to this if you study various examples of them, also the biographies of many geniuses, but not from the standpoint of that arch Philistine Lombroso. What is so disgusting, ekelhaft, about Lombroso's theory is not his own great genius, that has to be acknowledged, but the fact that he is a thorough Philistine, that on every page you read commonplace opinions. It simply has to be admitted that science has fallen to that level. If one refuses to accept assertions from that kind of standpoint, if one directs one's activity from a really thoughtful perception of the world, that is, of physical and spiritual life, then, if one needs to offer comfort to a sick person in the course of one's work, one will offer the comfort of religion, or one will offer the sacrament, with a true spiritual aura, but not without clear understanding behind it. Whether one gives communion to a sick person in the right way, so that he begins to improve, so that during his convalescence his soul is in no way injured, depends upon one's having an understanding for these things. You see, it has meaning, we will speak of this later, that for certain convalescents their physical healing will not be complete without the sacrament of communion, so that what had been brought into disarray in their karma can be put in order again. If one does not know that, one cannot carry it into the aura of the sacrament. But if also the physician understands these things, if he recognizes karma working through the illness, while he keeps professional command of the healing process, he will be able to relate himself to it in the right way. He must observe these things with his whole being from a broad world view. Then something objective will happen for him, if he works consciously with his whole soul to help the karmic processes developing in the patient. His healing mission will then be the other half of the divine service. It will have a religious dimension, and he will learn to regard himself as the partner of the priest, as the one who stands beside the priest and administers the other half of the divine service. Healing becomes a divine service. Things that the materialistic world conception has turned into nature worship, to dancing around the golden calf, if I may use that Hebrew expression, these things must be returned and transformed to a divine service through proper anthroposophical understanding. To transform everything in life and art and religion into the service of God. That will be the ultimate task of a comprehensive pastoral medicine that can be practiced within the anthroposophical movement. But a beginning must be made. It must be initiated here. At least the indications must be given for it to those who will carry the impulse forward out of spiritual foundations for the two sides of a true divine service. That is why pastoral medicine is first being presented to priests and individuals within the anthroposophical movement. Those individuals will then find possibilities with their knowledge of nature and spirit for spreading it further. They will carry it particularly into the areas of life that lie within their own individual missions. We will continue this tomorrow. The end of Lecture 6.